the tally of the cake, but we'll persevere, and on we go with part two. And again, we're looking at the same family tree. I hope, actually, you'll appreciate this. It took me an entire day to do this, because, you know, when you draw a line and the other things drop down, and then they all go up like the front. Oh, my goodness, it took forever. Anyway, it worked. Now, Roger II dies and is succeeded by his son, William I, who's known as William the Bad, and then his son is known as William II, William the Good. He wasn't really all that bad, but I think basically it reflects the fact that almost invariably a very, very, very great father sort of dominates and intimidates his son, and he was a mere sort of cipher of his father. He also is very self-indulgent, and he takes multiculturalism a little far, because he literally spends months, if not years, secluded in his harem. So he doesn't really, he's not a very active participant in the politics of the country. He then is succeeded by his son William, who is known as the Good. So, there is recently reconstructed, now sadly in a rather sort of poorer area, not very rundown area of Sicily, called the Ziza Palace, which is begun for William I, just before he dies. He dies in 66, William I of Sicily. And it was a sort of wonderful, again, fusion of cultures. It looks Western outside, to a large extent, and then inside nothing survives of the furnishings or whatever, but certainly the structure survives. And there we have these amazing sort of honeycomb arches, typical of the Arab world. They're called Mukarna. And then again, the sort of fountain with its water will wash down that sort of washboard effect, glistening as it flows into a channel through the rooms to make them cooler and whatever. It's very much of the Middle Eastern feel. And this is very indicative of the continuing multiculturalism under William's son and grandson. The palace of the Ziza, which means Al-Aziz, which means mighty, and obviously it refers to the Norman kings. But William II is more significant. He succeeds when he's a young boy. When he attains his majority, he almost immediately begins to build the great cathedral of Monreale. And it's built in 8 years. It's an amazing structure, you'll see. He marries an English princess. She's the daughter of Henry II of England and Eleanor of Aquitaine. She was 11, he was 23. And then he sanctions the marriage of his aunt, Constance. We'll come back to her in a moment. And interestingly there, you can see, again from another of the Arab geographers and visitors, we're now 50 years on from Roger, where he talks about the attitude of the king is extraordinary, his attitude towards Muslims is perfect, then he says even the great intendant for cooking is a Muslim. In other words, you know, he trusts them so much that they won't be poisoned, and then the viziers and chamberlains are eunuchs, etc., etc. But I mean, it's a very laudatory reference by a visitor to Sicily at the end of the 1100s, during the reign of William, the good William II. But neither are really in the mould of their predecessor. But nevertheless, and this again is a detail of the palace of the Normans in Palermo. Now, what William II's greatest achievement and greatest contribution to the world, not just to Sicily, is Monreale Cathedral. Monreale, the Royal Mountain, it's just above Palermo. From the cathedral, you look back down to the Palermo in the distance, and all the arched portico there is later. Otherwise, the towers are original. Really very bad sort of disjointed structure outside, but inside It is an amazing building. It's been called one of the architectural wonders of the world. It's this huge cathedral with this amazing balance and harmony covered in these mosaics. And it's a greater, bigger version of the little cathedral by Roger at Cefalù. And it obviously, I think, is in his grandson's mind. William II is thinking, well, if Roger can do the Cefalù, I'll do one much bigger. But what is so extraordinary is this building is created in 8 years. And it's entirely covered with mosaics. All the walls, both the side walls and the walls of the nave, the apses, not only the major apse, and the entire cathedral is decorated with mosaics, which have slightly lost that early sort of dawn sort of spring freshness. They're slightly bigger and bulkier and heavier and grander, but nevertheless, the overall impact is sensational. And you see here a comparison. There is the apse with Christ Pantocrator. There's in detail. But then compare him to the one at Cefalù. And you can see that you've moved away from that early delicacy to a slightly grander, more powerful style. And the Christ there has been described as looking like an overfed Egyptian pasha. and he's got a strange wig on. It's very sort of ungainly. But nevertheless, I mean, that's just being facetious, because it is an amazing series of mosaics. They're dazzling, they're incredible. And again, to think that they were created in such a short space of time is extraordinary. And the cloister is miraculous. There was a cloister at Cefalù. There is one. But it was very badly damaged by fire in later centuries and has been also affected by the elements, being right on the sea. The stone has crumbled. Here, the cloister survives almost intact, as it was created about 800 years ago, 800 years plus. And although one could dwell on it, I'll just show you here the detail of one of the double capitals where Roger is presenting the cathedral to the Virgin and Child. And then similarly, inside the cathedral, on a side wall, William II. And William II is here also presenting the cathedral to the Virgin. But there are two very different styles. And there you see the emergence of, again, the tolerance, the multiculturalism, but also the arrival of northern influences. That by now, early styles are coming from the north to Sicily, whereas previously they were coming from the east. And here you can see, this is quite clearly a more traditional type of Western church. That is obviously an Oriental Byzantine church. But they're still very much within this orbit of the spirit established by Roger II, this great multiculturalism. And there again you look down onto Palermo. That is the view that you get of Palermo from Monreale, the great headland on the right there. And then if you go to that right-hand side, you then look across Palermo with this headland, which is called Monte Pellegrino, and Monreale will be up on the left. Now, William II will die in Palermo. And I'll now introduce you to what I find the most fascinating manuscript that survives, this illustrated manuscript, which now is in the Municipal Library of Bern in Switzerland. It's called the Liber ad Honorem Augusti. It's the book in honor of the emperor. It's written by a man from southern Italy, Pietro da Eboli, and in the book he shows him, he has himself painted, and each page of the manuscript has illustrations on the one side and the long, 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 long Latin poem about this very period. And it's almost like, and it has been compared to, the Bayeux tapestry about the Norman conquests. And here you see the people of Palermo mourning the death of William II. That is the Palatine Chapel. It tells you that up there. There are the districts of Palermo. People are weeping. They're tearing their hair out. They're beating their breasts, showing emotion, enormous emotion at the death of the king, rather like those people did so extraordinarily in North Korea the other day. And there is the port. There is the port. A very large fish in the port, and that's a chain, of course. All ports would have had a chain to prevent piracy and so on. And this is from this amazing book. It's wonderfully naive paintings. Now, the death is shown of William II, and there it is an Arab doctor in that illustration on the far left. Then that is William II being fanned as he's lying on his deathbed. Then there's an Arab astrologer. You see there in detail. He's consulting, and he's got an astrolabe in his hand. That is an Arab astrolabe, whereby you measure the sun and the moons and so on, and you can then plot the person's horoscope. And there, sadly, though, is Roger on his die. There's the dead Roger. Sorry, the dead William with his wife Joanna. All this from the Liber Adolorum Augusti. Now, as you see, as I've written there, from one of the wonderful books by John Julius Norwich, The Kingdom in the Sun. And he writes, "A kingdom in the sun, prosperous and peaceful, youth, good looks, and limitless wealth, the love of his subjects and a beautiful queen. With such gifts as these, William II must have appeared to his contemporaries as a man upon whom the gods had smiled." And so, up to a point, they had. Three blessings only they withheld from him. First, a long life. Second, a son and heir. Third, a modicum of political wisdom. Now, that's pretty harsh, and we'll see why John Julius is so harsh on him. I think quite unfairly, really, but... nevertheless, he gives this wonderful image and tragedy, really, of what has overtaken the Normans, you see. Because, by all rights, William II was a young man, his queen was a young woman, and they should have produced lots of children by now, which they didn't. And so the beginning of the end of the Normans occurs. Now, what happens is we go back to Constance. And Constance is the posthumous daughter of Roger. She's actually only a year older than William II, although they're aunt and nephew. They are of the same age. And we again look to the book of the emperor, the illustrated book I've just mentioned, for the bones of her life, of which we know virtually nothing. There is Roger. He's on a lovely bouncy rocking horse. There's Roger. There is Roger marrying his third wife, Beatrice of Rethel, who is German, and the marriage only lasts for about a year or so because Roger will die, leaving his wife pregnant, and his third wife then produces posthumously a little girl who's in swaddling clothes wearing a crown and suckling at her mother's breast, and there is the dead Roger. Now, that is Constance. That is Constance. Constance is the baby. And she's born in 1154. Now, we think that she went into a nunnery, but that doesn't mean she's a nun. Royal women very often, almost invariably actually, if they weren't married, entered a religious institution, but lived in great splendor, lived in great comfort, looked after by the nuns. They weren't actually necessarily absorbed into the order, accepted into the order. But nevertheless, why did William wait? That's where he doesn't have much intelligence. Why did William wait until his aunt was 30 to find her a suitable husband? All royal women, right through the centuries, have always been aware of the fact that from the moment they were born, that their whole role in life was to marry well, to advance the interests of their family. And why did Roger leave this? She was the last heiress of Sicily. She was the last holder of the kingdom of Sicily for the Normans, and he left it to the last minute. And eventually, though, she does marry, and this again is why he's criticized. He arranges the marriage with the son of the emperor in Germany. And there is the marriage between Constance. She's got a big, large ring which she's giving to her husband. Her husband is 9 years younger than she is. And they, I would have thought, have absolutely nothing in common at all. But nevertheless, she knows her role, and now she becomes the wife of the future emperor in Germany. And there they are. She's behind, looking quite happy, really. And there he is, going bouncy, 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 and the Pope is waving them goodbye. And they're off back to Germany. Now, Henry the Sixth, of course, nothing to do with the Henry the Sixth of England, so please don't get confused. This is Henry the Sixth of Germany. Why they all have the same name, why God alone knows. And Henry the Sixth is a horrid, ruthless, brutal man. I don't think he had anything in common with his wife. I don't think there's any love lost between them. But nevertheless, she was the great prize for him, because, of course, she will, as the Queen of Sicily now, or as the inheritor of the Kingdom of Sicily, he can become the King of Sicily. A huge asset. I mean, then it was the most powerful and richest kingdom in Western Europe. So again, there is William, there is Henry, Henry the Sixth. There is Henry the Sixth riding into Palermo with his wonderful knights. Don't you love them in their chainmail there, and their helmets. And there are the people processing in front of him, blowing their trumpets. It's a very, very, very early example of the vuvuzela. There he is, again with his knights, with the people of Palermo, loyally presenting petitions to him. He's received the crown of Sicily through marriage to Constance. But where is Constance? Constance, before Henry embarks on this expedition, was discovered to be pregnant. She was 40. She had never produced a child before that. And it would be impossible for her to remain to give birth in Germany, because nobody would believe that the child was the rightful heir to the Kingdom of Sicily. So she travels very slowly, as Henry rushes to Palermo, she travels very slowly down Italy, obviously hoping to get to Sicily in time to give birth, because whatever child she gives birth to, male or female, will inherit the Kingdom of Sicily. And she's 40. By which day, I mean, 40 for a medieval woman was dead old. I mean, dead old. Instead of which, she gets as far as Jesi, which is in the region today of the Marche. It's on the eastern coast of Italy, in the marshes, south of Urbino. It's a pretty little town of no great merit other than it produces good wine now. But its fame is that in Jesi, on Boxing Day, on the 26th of December, 1194, Constance gives birth to a son who's named Frederick after his German grandfather and Roger after his Norman grandfather. But she's 40. And the likelihood is that people would say that no, the child was born, stillborn or died or whatever. And so to prove that it is her son and it is the heir to the Kingdom of Sicily, she gives birth in public in the main square. And everybody watches. She's there giving the little baby to the Duchess of Spoleto, because she's going off to be crowned as the queen. That obviously gives legitimacy to her husband, and she's going to be crowned in Bari. She's an amazing woman. Now, amazing woman. And, of course, she will then produce Frederick II. Frederick II, the Holy Roman Emperor, you can see there the family tree now of the Hohenstaufen. So it's the German family tree, still though, with the Norman bloodline within them. My torch has run out, so I just want to change the battery, if you'll excuse me. No, I can't. Forget it. You'll just have to do without the torch. Now, there you can see Henry the Sixth of Hohenstaufen, the Holy Roman Emperor, King of Sicily, that's on the left, 1194 to 1197. 1194, you see, is when he's crowned. Constance's wife. She's the last holder of the title of the Norman kings of Sicily. Their son is Frederick II. He becomes the King of Sicily, and HRE stands for Holy Roman Emperor. And he becomes one of the most amazing people of the medieval world. It is extraordinary. I mean, this bloodline is fantastic, except for which that after that, sadly, all those little people at the bottom there die or are murdered or whatever. So the family dies out. We'll see why in a moment. But first of all, Constance's son, Frederick, was an orphan at the age of 4. He was brought up in Palermo under the aegis of the Pope, but he would probably have quite an easy life there. He was fluent in all the languages of his kingdom and mixed probably easily with the other boys in the streets and so on. But he had a vision. He had this Germanic power and strength within him. He was cruel and cultured, is Frederick II. And you see him here, the son of Constance, the only portrait we have of him from his own book that he writes about hunting with birds. You can see he was the stupor mundi. He was the wonder of the world. He was ruthless. He was incredibly forceful. He was so powerful that nobody could stand up to him. And he just walked through Europe, strode across Europe. Crowned the King of Sicily at the age of 4, crowned the King of the Germans, crowned the Holy Roman Emperor, crowned the King of Jerusalem. And he is an incredibly powerful man. He had to rule as the Holy Roman Emperor, so often he did, for years on end, go back to Germany, but always his heart and his soul and his court was in Palermo. And he is this extraordinary contrast between Germanic strength and power and cultural multiculturalism of his Norman ancestors. He writes this book, which is called, as you see there, The Art of Hunting. Obviously, it's in manuscript form, and this is a manuscript in the Vatican with these amazing illustrations. Don't you love the one on the top right where those chaps are tying? And by the way, it's not just simply a pretty picture book. It's a very serious, very advanced, extraordinarily informative manual on how you do hunt with birds. But there the birds are being tied up on a pole, and I do love this stripy dressing gowns they're wearing. What's going wrong? Oh, that's very sweet of you, thank you. Oh, you are kind, thank you. There we are, that's very sweet of you. Not nearly as good as mine, but thank you very, very much. And then, these are his achievements. The School of Sicilian Poetry, called the birthplace of Italian literature. Why? Because he groups round him a group of poets who will be following the Provençal tradition of the courtly love poems, the Romance of the Rose and so on, which is written in the Provençal dialect. Similarly here, they're writing in vernacular, early Italian dialect, one of their number will be credited with inventing the sonnet. The University of Naples, the Federico II University, is the first state university in the world, the first university without any church authority. Frederick was absolutely implacably and totally against the church. He loathed the church, and he was too powerful for anyone to stop him. And he starts this university, which is an incredible institution. And one of its earliest alumni was a cousin of Frederick II, who becomes the great Christian philosopher of the time, St. Thomas Aquinas. The constitutions of Melfi. This is a constitution for his people of the Kingdom of Sicily, which took place in Melfi, which is where Robert Guiscard was the first Norman to be offered the control of Sicily. And there, 2 centuries later, the constitution written in Latin and Greek, which applied to all the citizens of his realms. Lombards means northern Italians, Greeks, Arabs, Germans, Jews. The certificate of the modern administrative state. I mean, he is the most incredibly powerful, ruthless, terrifying, but also incredibly cultured man. All those diverse genes within him from the Normans and the Hohenstaufen sides. And then his tomb, again, one of these wonderful tombs in Palermo. And, of course, he's venerated by the Germans as one of their greatest early monarchs, or one of their greatest early emperors. And the tombs in Palermo are actually in a separate section now, which is nice, because you have to pay a little, only a euro or two, I think. And you go in, and when I went in initially, when I took these photographs, there was nobody there. and I was having a lovely time, and you, then suddenly a group of Germans came in with their tour leader, and I by then was photographing, and I left my hat down there, Panama hat, with a guidebook, I think, or something. And you would have thought that I'd gone off and murdered Angela Merkel. I mean, it was just incredible. They attacked me, I mean, beyond belief. And of course, I was desecrating, I suppose I was. I was being, I wasn't paying due attention to this amazing man. And I agree. I mean, they left a bunch of flowers there instead, so there we are. But there is Frederick II. Now, what happens? You see, while Frederick II lives, the papacy has to endure him. And what they couldn't stand about it was that, you see, he was the emperor in the north and he was the king in the south. He actually squashed the Pope in the middle. And therefore, the Pope naturally wanted somebody else to counter. They can't get rid of the emperor in the north, but they can somehow get somebody else to capture Sicily. And this is what the popes do. In the 1220s, I beg your pardon, the 1260s, the Pope at the time is French. And so is his successor, Urban and Clement. They're both French. And what they do is invite a French nobleman called Charles of Anjou, brother of the King of France, Louis IX, who was later canonized as St. Louis, and they invite him to come and take over Sicily. And he does so with incredible force, and he's the most unpleasant man, Charles of Anjou. He's a monster, really. He first of all captures Frederick II's illegitimate son, who's in line to succeed, and he kills him in battle. Then Frederick II's grandson, Conradin, comes from Germany, and he kills him. He actually has him slaughtered in the square of Naples. I mean, he's a ruthless, ruthless man of no charm whatsoever. For Charles of Anjou, and in fact, as has been written very recently, there is the Pope crowning him. There's again a rather lovely fresco, actually, from early frescoes in the French church. There is the same Pope, Clement IV, investing him with Naples and Sicily. But as has been recently written of this man, when the popes at this stage, after he'd been slaughtering all these descendants of the Frederick II and getting them out of the way, it's said that perhaps the popes began to wonder what monster they'd invited into their midst. And he takes over Sicily. The beginning of the end for poor old Sicily. That's why John Julius is so unkind to William II, because this all results from that marriage. But you can't be wise, too wise after the event. But this is terrible for Sicily, because now you see it just becomes a football that's kicked around by successive people as they go in and out of Sicily. And Charles of Anjou is a perfect example of that. He imposes French authority, French diplomats or French bureaucrats, French soldiers, but it doesn't last very long. He is invested in 1265, 1266. And then in 1282, less than 20 years, there is the Sicilian Vespers. The Sicilian Vespers is a phrase we all know about, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with little motorcycles going buzz, 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 buzz. This is the evening service. It took place on Easter Monday outside a church in Palermo. The church still exists, just. It's a very ruined building now. And the church was the Church of the Holy Ghost. And outside this church, on the Easter Monday, at the evening service, people were assembling, and a French soldier, the French were loathed by the local populace, starts to, approaches a woman and says he wishes to examine her because he thinks she's carrying arms. Well, he touches her up, in other words, offends the husband, the husband murders the soldier. That's all taking place there, you see. That's the soldiers on the ground about to be slaughtered. This is a totally imaginary painting of the 19th century by a very good, very famous Franco-Italian artist called Francesco Hayez. So this attack, which seemed spontaneous, sort of like an Arab Spring, then launches this tremendous reaction to the French, who are then either, those officials who have already been imposed on the island, are either killed or then escape. So it's a very brief period, but it does lead, as I say, this brutal period leads towards the Sicilian Lesbos, which is a phrase we all know about, and it is an opera today by Verdi as well. But after that, and one must say that obviously it couldn't have been that spontaneous, this revolution, because there must have been Spanish Aragonese sort of agents sort of ferreting around and getting the people worked up. Because almost immediately this happens, the Aragonese arrive in the port of Trapani, which is on the western coast. They've come from Spain to claim Sicily. The Aragonese have a right to do this because Pedro III, Peter III, the King of Aragon, is married to Constance of Sicily, of course not the same woman who gave birth in Iesi. This is a much later woman whose great-grandparents are Henry VI and Constance of Sicily. So she has this tenuous claim, very, very tenuous claim to the Kingdom of Sicily. And so Constance arrives with her husband Pedro, introducing the Aragonese northern Spanish Gothic style. And so then another succession occurs, another country takes over. And the south portal here of Palermo Cathedral, this is Palermo Cathedral, which was begun by Roger a long time ago, now in the 1400s, is given this wonderful decoration, which is late Gothic. And there's the arms of Aragon. Look at that lovely detail there, of the portal there. Lovely, lovely carvings. The vegetation, the chevron, and so on. It's superb, of its type. But now, for the rest of time, Sicily has lost this great flowering, this great burst in the sky, this kingdom in the sun, and now it is subservient to other people imposing their style, their ornament, their decoration, their rule upon them. And the Aragonese rule is actually very beneficial. Now, the Kingdom of Aragon is a small... the Kingdom of Aragon was a small northeastern part of Spain, but it grew quite substantially through the period when they become the kings of Sicily, and then they actually also capture the southern Italy as well. And this occurs under the most important Aragonese king, who imposes his authority on the Sicily and southern Italy. He's Alfonso V. He will be contemporary with all the other great names of the early Renaissance in Italy. He will be contemporary with the early Medici in Florence, where the Renaissance is flowering now with Donatello, Fra Angelico, and so on. He'll be contemporary with the Este in Ferrara, the Gonzaga in Mantua, the Visconti and Sforza in Milan, all these great families who are very much initiating this enormous explosion of Western civilization. And he's on a par with them. He's a very great patron. He's a very artistic patron, and he will see his impact in a moment. He's called the Magnanimous because he actually maintains peace in his Sicilian kingdom. And here again, the most famous, the most important name of Sicilian art of the Western period is Antonello da Messina. He comes, of course, from Messina in northern Sicily, and he will actually study in Naples. He'll be an apprentice under a very minor artist, but he'll be there when, at the court of Alfonso V in Naples. Alfonso V isn't based in Sicily, but he's based in Naples, and he'll study and be absorbed the influences coming from the north, coming through, and we know that one of the great artists from Flanders is Roger van der Weyden, and he will be in Naples in 1450. And it has been written, the only major southern Italian painter of the 15th century, the only Italian decisively influenced by the oil technique associated with the Van Eycks, Antonello. He's a very great name. He doesn't really get the recognition he should do. And he was also responsible for developing the art of portraiture, prior to Antonella da Pessina, the portrait, normally a Renaissance portrait, is simply a profile. You just see the one half of the face. Now the face turns into three-quarter profile, wonderfully moulded, an amazing psychology. This is the earliest of these, and there are others as well, by the way, but I'm showing you six. This is the portrait in Chaffalou. We don't know who they are. This is Cefalù. We're in that lovely little village, little town I showed you, called the Sailor, but I mean, he could be anybody, really. Slightly sort of supercilious smirk on his face. That chap looks fairly intense. Lovely big eyes looking up towards you. That's in the Thyssen collection in Madrid, signed. A wonderful painting in London, one of the most famous, which could be his own self-portrait, but that's totally unrecorded. Real tough guy from the Louvre there, called the Soldier, the Condottiere, dated. That's in Turin, he's called the Banker. And you can see that sort of supercilious look. I mean, you want a loan, he's saying. There again, that slightly sort of vacant youth at the end there, but interestingly, there's a touch of a distant horizon there, which is a new development. He's very innovatory. He's acquiring knowledge from Northern art. How he does it, we don't know. People do suggest he actually went up to Flanders. But nevertheless, he's acquiring a knowledge which is here revolutionizing and augmenting the Italian Renaissance. His most famous work in Sicily, in Palermo, in the Palazzo Abbatelis, is quite supremely beautiful. Wonderfully composed, incredibly powerful, three-dimensional image of the Virgin, who it's regarded as a single painting. It doesn't have a companion, which could have contained a painting of the angel, Angel Gabriel coming to announce to the Virgin the imminent birth of Christ. And there she is, simply, we are the angel. She's sort of holding up her hand in surprise, stopping reading, looking at us, this incredibly beautiful image, a superb southern Italian face, painted about 1475 when he's in Venice. He goes to Venice at one stage, a very important influence as well. He's a very great man. Now, the most regarded as, in fact, somebody had written recently that this painting in the National Gallery, none of them are very big, of course, these are all quite small, paintings. I mean, they're not vast. They're not nearly as big as you see on the screen. This is about 18 inches high. It's in the National Gallery. You can see it any day you like in the Sainsbury Wing. And it's one, somebody's written recently, this is one of the masterpieces of the Italian Renaissance. It is so wonderful, these wonderful views there. Look at the distant window in detail there, the countryside, the intensity of the light. The birds, the floor, St. Jerome. We know it's St. Jerome because there's a lion coming in there. The lion, of course, St. Jerome took a thorn from a lion's paw, and then the lion became his best friend. And there you see this painting by Antonello da Messina. As I say, a man who puts Sicily on the map. I mean, he is the great artist of Sicily, working in the 1400s. And then, as you see there, that is Aragon. It's really only the eastern side of Spain. Castile was a much, much bigger kingdom. And then, of course, Ferdinand of Aragon marries Isabella of Castile. And that's when the Catholic kings, as they're called, unite Spain into a single entity. Which is when, in fact, Aragonese rule stops and the rule passes through their daughter, Joanna, to Joanna's son, who is Charles V. He's the great Holy Roman Emperor, the Habsburg, and for 200 years the Habsburgs will rule Sicily through the offices of a viceroy. I don't think even one single Habsburg emperor even bothered to put foot in Sicily. They simply ruled it as a distant island with no real great significance to their power politics. And that is, of course, when Sicily does decline so dramatically. It's now lost all that amazing flourish, that explosion, like Etna, of exploding in the sky with the Normans and the Hohenstaufens. And now it's just a backwater ruled by the Habsburgs by default, really, for 200 years until 1713. During that time, obviously, life goes on. People die, people are born, the world continues, Etna erupts. And there, in fact, is a view of the city of Catania, which is the second city of Italy today, Sicily rather. Palermo is the biggest, Catania is the second. And there you can see from a painting in the cathedral the miraculous diversion of a lava flow which didn't cover and come into the town of Catania. Obviously, this was engineered through the patron saint of Catania, who is St. Agatha. That occurred in 1699, when the city was largely saved. However, St. Agatha, however good she is at diverting lava flows, she's no good at preventing earthquakes. And there is, in 1693, this very, very serious earthquake in the whole of southeastern Sicily. It does enormous damage. It virtually destroys the entire city, as you see there, of Catania. And so Catania today is rebuilt, and it's rebuilt in the 18th century as a planned, formal, very grand city, which has now been given World Heritage status by UNESCO. Now, there is the patron saint of the city, St. Agatha, who had suffered terrible torture. She had her breasts torn out. She was visited by St. Peter and he cured them. But then 4 days later, she was going to be burnt. And then finally, she begs Christ to end it all. A year after her death, Catania was threatened with destruction, and the molten lava was diverted by the people showing her cloak. So she's always shown, not always, but generally shown with her breasts on a plate looking like two buns, and there the long cloak. Beautiful painting by Zurbaran, who is, of course, a contemporary of Velasquez, and she's the patron saint of breast cancer. Now, the Feast of St. Agatha. The feast of St. Agatha is in February, when it's a national holiday in Catania, and you can then buy a special cake, which was originally only made by the nuns of Monreale, and it's called the Minne di Vergine, which sounds slightly better than the English translation. I wouldn't really like to go into a shop and say I'll have a dozen virgins. Now, the Cathedral of Catania is dedicated to St. Agatha, and it is all part of this wonderful planned city, and a minor artist, a local chap called Vaccarini, who quite clearly in this obelisk, which is the symbol of the city, is an obelisk on the back of an elephant, which of course is based on Bernini's famous obelisk with an elephant holding it in Rome. But it's a minor, it's a sort of poor version, except the fascinating part is, you can see it perhaps a little clearer there, it's actually made of lava, because of course we're very close to Mount Etna, and it's actually carved lava, solid rock, volcanic rock, and it's thought to be very early. Whether it's exactly Roman or not, we don't know. But now St. Agatha is celebrated in February, and of course her terrible martyrdom is recorded in her little cakes. But the elephant, when it was erected in the square as a symbol of Catania, was appallingly criticized by the male population of Catania, because the elephant seemingly is male and it had no testicles. So now, if you go to Catania and you approach the elephant, you can peer up and someone's placed them in there. So you've got the Zagatha's breasts and the elephant's testicles. So there you are. Now, the earthquake is very, very destructive, and it has resulted in Oh, quite a number. I mean, there are a good half dozen, if not more, cities in southeastern Sicily which are entirely rebuilt. They're these Baroque cities in this distinctive style of late Baroque architecture. Noto is right on the down by the coast of southern Sicily, southeastern Sicily. It's only the southeast that's affected. Palermo, fortunately, wasn't damaged at this time, nor was Agrigento. And there is the Baroque city of Noto with this wonderful cathedral, the cathedral there of San Nicola. And there you can see it, this amazing, this enormously grand, this powerful, monumental facade. Now, obviously, this is derivative Sicilian Baroque of what, of course, was the great Roman invention. But the Baroque derives in Rome 150 years before. And that this twin tiles, leading the curving volutes towards the centre, is a reflection, it's not a copy, but it's a reflection of the famous church in the Piazza Navona in Rome, the church of Sant'Agnese, Sant'Agnes, by Borromini. It's in this instance by a man who does a lot of work in this idiom, a man called Gagliardi. However, in 1996, the dome and the entire nave of this church collapsed. I think you may possibly vaguely recall it. I mean, it was an event which was recorded right around the world. It was a shock. It was the most terrible, terrible disgrace to Sicily in particular and the Italian cultural establishment in general, because the cathedral had been damaged and nobody even bothered to repair it. So then just one day the cathedral thought, well, blow this, and it just sort of, whoops, it collapsed. It was a wake-up call, which obviously then brought in the world sort of heritage funds and so on. And so now it's a UNESCO heritage site, but obviously it also was a very strong wake-up call to the Sicilian regional parliament to jolly well do something now and preserve their buildings. And now you can see it has been rebuilt, the dome and the nave, at the cost of £17 million, mind you. But it was a very serious event which actually, in a way, has galvanized Sicily to now being aware of its heritage, which, of heaven's alive, there's enough of it, and they jolly well should be aware of it. The other town I'm showing you briefly is Ragusa, which is in two parts. We're looking towards the hilltop there, which is called Ragusa Ibla, and there is the town of Ragusa, very close to Syracuse. Syracuse wasn't badly damaged in the earthquake, fortunately. There we can see the Cathedral of Ragusa. And it's, again, by the same man, Gagliardi, the Cathedral of St. George, this wonderful sort of build-up to the centre with these great columns and so on. It's a very distinctive and very significant style of the Sicilian Baroque. Now, in Palermo before that, but just discussing briefly one or two of its features, Palermo has a, it's called the La Fontana Pretoria. Now, you don't have to puff up your little chest with pride because it's got absolutely nothing to do with the capital of South Africa. It relates to the Praetorian Guard, the Roman Guard. But it was a huge fountain in the middle of the old town of Palermo, which was actually purchased from Tuscany. It was made in Tuscany and then re-erected here as a great symbol now of the city's pride and wealth and whatever. And the people of Palermo have always called it the Fountain of Shame, the Fontana della Vergogna, because of its very, very obvious full frontal nudity, which the Palermitans didn't actually like. In the centre of the old city of Palermo, there's this wonderful piece of town planning in early 1600s by a man called Lasso, the Four Corners. The Four Corners, obviously you can't see the fourth, but they're fountains of the four seasons, four Habsburg kings. The Habsburg kings are still ruling then. And then the four saints, who are the protectors of Palermo. It's a very good, it's a very, very, actually more than good, it's a very, very significant piece of town planning. And actually, the crossing between Oxford Street and Regent Street, designed by John Nash in the 1800s, also has four corners. Whether he was inspired by them, I could imagine he was. Now, in Palermo, there is a little building, which is really a must if you go. It's not on the general tourist circuit, but it's called the Oratory of the Rosary of Santa Chita. And it's this little building which is decorated by this man here called Giacomo Serpotta, who has been claimed by the very wonderful art historian Rudolf Witkover that Serpotta is a meteor in the Sicilian sky. Why? Because he was a stuccoist, a minor art, therefore it's not generally on the tourist circuit, but there, look at this incredible, there is the little oratory, with, by the way, a painting by Van Dyck. Van Dyck visits Sicily in 1624. It's the Madonna of the Rosary. She's giving a rosary to St. Dominic. But if you turn round and see the entrance wall of this little building, there, look at this incredible plasterwork. It's quite superb plasterwork. And that figure there is the figure just on the bottom down here. This little urchin, obviously taken off the streets, by Serpotta created in this superbly sculpted form. This is all, as I say, a minor art, but a meteor in the sky. Now, just to coast home briefly, after the Habsburgs, we do have a very interesting, very significant period during the Bourbons. They come along now, the French Bourbons. Charles of Bourbon becomes Charles III of the King of Sicily and Naples. He takes the title, this rather strange title, of the King of the Two Sicilies, which means Palermo and Naples, Sicily and southern Italy. And he's a very, very, very good man. He's one of these 18th century sophisticated aristocratic patrons, artistic, and it is during his period, he doesn't live in Sicily, but he in Naples itself, Naples in the mid-18th century will become one of the great visiting points of interest for the grand tourist, this wonderful Bay of Naples, which still today is fantastic. In the 18th century, Vesuvius was always erupting. You can see there are these paintings by the German artist. And during Charles III's reign in the 18th century, Herculaneum and Pompeii are discovered. So Naples becomes a very significant part of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. And he creates this wonderful palace. This is at Caserta, which is outside Naples, and there this enormous Baroque palace, and this garden that goes on and on and on and on and on. And there you see it from the other end, going back and back and back to the palace. Well, that's one of the great intermediary sculpted groups where these cascades come down, and that, I mean, can't be better as a grand staircase, for goodness sake. It's the most amazing palace, actually. It's fantastic to visit. And this is all during this very, very vibrant period of the 1730s, 1750s in Naples. He then leaves. Charles III leaves to become the King of Spain, and his son, Ferdinand, inherits the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. The kingdom, which includes the southern Italy and Naples and Sicily, southern Italy and Sicily. There is the future king. This is the next king, Ferdinand I, who is actually the most boorish man. He's an oaf. He has no brains. He has no interest. He has no whatever. Married to a Habsburg, one of the Habsburg daughters of Marie Theresia. She's a sister of Marie Antoinette. But they reign at a period of very great significance because they're ruling at the end of the 18th century when, in fact, on two occasions, they have to flee from Naples, 1798 to 1800 and 1806 to 1815, when they flee from Naples from the French, seek refuge in their other kingdom, which is Sicily, and they're helped in this by Nelson. And Nelson, because of that, is awarded by Ferdinand I of the Two Sicilies, he's awarded the dukedom of Bronte. And that is Lord Nelson. He will, on two occasions, as I say, transport the royal family from Naples to Sicily on the Vanguard, and in doing so, he becomes the Duke of Bronte. This little town on the foothills of Mount Etna is then given to him as a sort of fiefdom. That is so-called his castle, but actually it was a monastery that becomes a residence. He never himself goes there. And there again is the castle today. But his heirs and descendants do continue to own this until 1982. But most interestingly, I do wonder whether I never knew this until recently. An Ulsterman, in other words, he's a man from Northern Ireland, which wasn't then divided, but a man from Northern Ireland, an Ulsterman called Patrick Brunty, as a young man found Nelson such an inspiring role model that when he was created the Duke of Bronte, Patrick Brunty changes his name to Bronte. He doesn't think, and then puts two little dots, puts a little umlaut on top. And he, Patrick Bronte now, becomes the rector of Howth in Yorkshire, and his daughters are the three sisters, Emily, Anne, and Charlotte Bronte. And do you think they'd have been as famous as Charlotte Bronte? I'm not terribly sure, but that is how they get their name, through Nelson, through Cicely, who he has so much to answer for in our lives. Finally, the king's grandson of Ferdinand I, who awarded Nelson the dukedom, Ferdinand II, is the king during the uprising in Palermo on the 12th of January 1848. 1848, of course, is the year of revolutions, the Commune in Paris, Les Miserables, in other words, the uprisings in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This is the spark that ignited it. It was like, again, an Arab Spring. The revolution spread through Europe in 48, starting in Palermo. For 16 months, they were independent, led by a man who gave himself the title of Ruggiero VII, which was Roger VII, obviously taking the name from our famous Roger. The revolution is suppressed by Ferdinand II, and he bombs Sicily so badly that he's called Re Bomba, the King Bomb. And so finally we lead to the end of Sicily as an entity. Garibaldi invades in 1860. He invades in Marsala. That is Garibaldi. The Italian post office gives us the history. That is on the 6th of May, Garibaldi departs from Genoa to then disembark in Marsala on the west coast. Then a few days later, on about the 15th of May, the first victory will occur. He arrives with his thousand soldiers dressed in red shirts. Mussolini's followers dressed in black shirts. This is the red shirts of Garibaldi, and there they very shortly actually conquer Sicily, and by October 1860 there is Garibaldi meeting the King of Savoy, way in the north, Turin, and the King Victor Emmanuel, who now becomes the King of a united Italy. It all begins in Sicily. And Sicily then, whether they liked it or not, was absorbed into the new Kingdom of Italy. And again, as I say, Kingdom of Sicily was again an island ruled from afar. And this all is part of the story, and a lot of you may have gone yesterday, the day before, to see the famous film, one of the greatest films ever made, The Leopard, and one of the greatest pieces of literature of the 20th century, which you must read if you haven't. This is a new edition, by the way, just out, newly republished. And it's all about, as you know, the Princess Selina, who is of the old guard. He says in the book that his ancestors arrived with Charles of Anjou. He'd been there for 800 years in Sicily, etc., etc. And he is then entering his fiefdom. He had an enormous estate in the centre of Italy called Donna Fugata. His heir is his nephew, played by Alain Delon. The prince is played by Burt Lancaster. Alain Delon, who falls in love with the mayor's daughter, played by Cardinale. And the mayor of Donna Fugata is a typical little money-grubbing, dishonest dictator, the basis of the mafia, really. And his daughter, though, is beautiful, and so it's money, and she's got lots of money. He's made money illegally, of course. His daughter is money, marrying, title. That is the capture of Palermo by the red shirts. You can see them there. And then the famous ball at the end, where the prince dances with the mayor's daughter. In other words, the new world has entered Sicily. The old world is gone. The old world of privilege, the old world of multiculturalism, the old world of Roger II, this wonderful, wonderful island which produced such amazing things over so many, many, over millenniums, this extraordinary island of Sicily. And thank you very much indeed.